We're to the crucifixion today. Difficult passage, but one that I hope we can understand. There's been a lot of false understandings around this, and we're going to try to clear some of those up. I think it's going to be interesting to see it as the way it was. And I hope that I'm going to be able to do so much more for you than just help you see the meaning of a few words. I hope if you'll let the Spirit of God today just kind of set you up on that cold, windswept hill and picture what it must have been like for our Lord to die on your behalf. We begin back with Pilate in chapter 15, 16. Then the soldiers led him away to a place inside the courtyard, that is of the governor's palace. Now, I'm using a Williams translation. I really like Williams because I think it keeps the verb tenses so well. But he doesn't do so good on the nouns. This is the word praetorium. That's a Latin word for the place where in this case, it'd be Pilate, the prefect, gave justice. It may be a procurator in other places or whatever. Do you remember that Mark is written to Romans because of so many Latinisms in it? And so the Romans would have known exactly, and we're not sure it was the governor's palace at all. It may have been the Fortress Antonio. So William's a little bit interpretive here. Notice where it says, and they called the whole battalion together. Now, probably these were not all Romans, but probably Syrians that the Romans had hired, because it was a province of Syria. And how many, I don't know. It may have been loyal Romans that followed the chief political officer around. Probably it wasn't as large as all that, but very veteran soldiers, if you please. And they dressed him in a purple robe. Now, in Matthew 27:28, it says scarlet. Now, of course, purple is the color of royalty. Most of the captains in the Roman army had scarlet capes. But after a few years, the scarlet kind of melted out into a purple. And so I think purple is what it was. It was a faded scarlet captain's cloak that was the symbol of royalty. And that's probably why they were doing it this way. Dressed him in a purple robe and put a crown of thorns and crowned him with it. Now, this wasn't probably to hurt him anymore. I think he's beaten so badly that I think he's probably insensitive to the pain of that. But I think what it is, it's a word that means a victor's crown. It was used of the emperor. Now, what they're going to do, they're going to put a purple robe on him. They're going to put this crown of thorns. They're going to put a reed in his hand as a scepter. They're mocking him as the king of the Jews. That's what they're doing. Now, these soldiers hated the Jews. These Jews were ugly, arrogant to them, and they just kind of took it out on Jesus, I want you to know. Now, I think because of Luke 23:10 that Herod's soldiers did something of the same thing. Now, and this says in verse 18, and they began to shout at him, "All hail, you King of the Jews!" And they kept hitting him on the head with a stick. Well, that's not real good. They put a reed in his hand as a scepter, and they would take that reed out of his hand and hit him on the head with it. It was a way of mocking him. So it wasn't a real physical abuse here. It's just mocking. And they kept spitting on him and bending their knees, mock homage. And they kept doing him homage. Now, you can imagine this going on for, I don't know how long, but this long period of time. Long period of time. Notice, then, if you will, where it mentions here, let's see. Then they had finished and making sport of him, they took off the purple robe and put his own robes on him. Now, I don't know how naked Jesus was, but obviously, probably had just his loincloth. Jews tend to wear four outer clothing garments. Now, one of them would have been the outer cloak they sleep in, then an inner robe, then some undergarments. Probably he was just had his loincloth under that. Now, then it says, and they led him out of the city to crucify him. Now, this out of the city is significant because in the Old Testament, many people were taken out of the city. They wouldn't kill anyone inside. And you see that from Leviticus 24:14, Numbers 15, 35, and 36. So they took him outside to crucify him. Here is Jesus dying on our behalf, cursed for us. Galatians 3, 13. You might look in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 21:23, for the curse of God on those who hang on a cross. Now, and they forced a certain passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross, Simon, a Cyrenian. Now, Simon the Cyrenian is a very interesting person, and I have a graphic I want to show you that really talks about him. The name Simon is, of course, a Jewish name, and since it said he was coming in from the country, I think he was just a pilgrim coming to Passover that happened to be staying outside and was coming in to worship. So I think he's not so much a black man, though Cyrene is a Roman province in North Africa. I really think he's a Jew, because look at that number two, how many references to Cyrenian Jews there are in the book of Acts. And then finally, I want you to notice that him and his sons were apparently very well known in the early church. Now remember that Mark is written to Romans. And in Romans 16:13, there's a reference to Rufus, which may be this man's son. It's quite possible, same Rufus. And so because it says that his sons Alexander and Rufus, that seems this man became very well known in the early church. Now, when it says carry his cross, what we have here, crucified criminals were flogged, and then they had to carry their own crossbeam. Now, we're not sure exactly what the form of this cross was. And I know that's unusual to you because you've always pictured like a T, okay? But I really think there are two other archaeological types that we found. One of them is a capital T where the cross beam is just across the top. And the other one we found is an X where people were attached to the four different members. It seems because it says they put the charge over his head that the traditional cross that we think of is probably what that was, but we're not certain. Now, I want to talk a little bit about crucifixion if I could. Crucifixion basically was not a nail in the palms, because that would rip out. But it was in through the bones of the wrist. And they tied the arms to the cross to hold most of the body weight. Then they bent the knees slightly and nailed the feet to a little rectangular box. And the reason for that is that the person had to push up on those nails in his feet to get his breath, because your arms hanging like this, your diaphragm quits functioning. And so you have to push up to breathe. It became very painful. Every breath you have to push up on your feet. And so most people died from asphyxiation, not from anything else. The Romans got crucifixion from the Phoenicians. Now we learn from history that Alexander the Great finally conquered Tyre and he crucified 2,000 people. But the Romans perfected this torture so it lasted several days. And the purpose for this was they wanted to have a deterrent to crime. Now, no Roman citizen could be crucified, and only the more horrendous crimes to the Romans was justified for crucifixion. And so many of these folks lived 2 or 3 days before they died. It was a horrendously awful, terrible thing. Now, notice it says, and they forced a certain... By the way, the word forced is a Persian loan word that means forced in the governmental service, okay? And they forced a certain passerby who was coming from the country to carry his crossbar, Simon a Cyrenian, father of Alexander and Rufus. And they led him to Golgotha. Golgotha. I have another graphic on that I want to show you. Golgotha is Aramaic for the skull. Now, we get the word Calvary from the Latin, which means a skull or skull cap. Now, I don't think that Gardens Calvary that you see in modern Israel has anything to do with what we're talking about. Because we're not talking about the eye sockets and the nose. We're talking about a low, bald hill that must have been very close to a major road, because the Romans marched these prisoners the longest distance possible through the streets of Jerusalem to strike fear in the heart of everyone. And they crucified these folks right on major roads so everybody could see them. And so I think it was on a major road. Now, some have said, well, it's because a lot of skulls were laying around. Friends, this is Judea. The Jews got extremely nervous at unburied bodies. They wouldn't let a bunch of skulls be laying around. And so it's probably just a low, bald hill. Now, people were crucified only about a foot off the ground, as far as their feet were about a foot from the ground, not way lifted up. And so I think we have some misconceptions about all that. The place of the skull. They offered him wine flavored with myrrh, but he would not take it. Now, they offered him is the imperfect tense. They offered him over and over. Well, who is the they? I believe it's the women of Jerusalem. And I want to show you a graphic, if I could, to show you what I think is the background to this. The women of Jerusalem were trying to follow what they understood of Proverbs 31, verses 6 and 7. It was drugged wine, very strong wine, to ease the pain of these condemned criminals. And they would give it to everybody who the Romans crucified. Also, I really believe what we have here is maybe a fulfillment of predictive prophecy from Psalm 69, 21. But Jesus did not want to do this. He wanted to experience the fullness of what he was going through. And so when he found out what it was, he refused it. Notice what it says in verse 24. And they crucified him and divided among them his clothes by throwing lots for them to see which piece each of them should have. Now, these Roman soldiers that crucified people, this regular detachment, and they did it all the time. They had seen many folks die. They had, for their splitting up, the possessions of the condemned men. And they were casting dice for this man's clothes. For the two thieves and Jesus, they were casting lots for see who got what piece. They could set it, I guess. You might well see Psalms 22:18 that so depicts this. Friends, I will tell you, Psalms 22 and Isaiah 53 give us the details of the crucifixion hundreds of years before Jesus was ever born. Notice where it mentions then, in verse 25, it was 9 o'clock in the morning. Now, Williams is trying to make this contemporary for English-speaking people. What we have literally here is the third hour. And you might want to see in John 19:14, it has the sixth hour. Now, this is an obvious contradiction. One says the third hour, one says the sixth hour. The only way I know to reconcile this is that many times in John, he uses Roman time. Now, he does use Jewish time some, but mostly Roman. Roman time started at 6 a.m. in the morning. But Jewish time would start at 6 p.m. And so the synoptics use Jewish time. John seems to use Romans time. So this is right. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning, okay? When they crucified him, and the notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." Now, we learn from John 19, 20 through 22, is put in three languages. Every one of the Gospels is different. They say it a little bit different, what the charge was. Now, because they say it different, to me, that shows authenticity and genuineness of eyewitness accounts and not some kind of forced uniformity. So I think it speaks of the validity of the account, not of some contradiction. By the way, the Jews really got upset about this because they said, change it to, "He claimed to be the King of the Jews." Now, Pilate didn't like the Jews. He didn't get along with it at all. If he could stick a barb in them, he would. And apparently, that's what he did. He said, "What I have written, I have written." They crucified two robbers along with him. You ought to see Isaiah 53:12. Oh, the Bible has such great evidence for its supernaturalness. It's a supernatural book. One on his right, one on his left. And the passerbyers kept hissing at him and shaking their heads, saying. Now, obviously, passerbyers meant it was on a major road. Now, notice where it says shaking their heads. In Psalms 22:7, this is something that is mentioned that they're going to do, shake their heads and hiss at him. So here we have another obvious predictive prophecy being fulfilled. Now, I want to mention to you that it says here, the man who would tear down the temple and build another in 3 days, save yourself by coming down from the cross. This seems to imply that these men were there at that night trial before Caiaphas because they heard the accusations. And so this seems to be part of the crowd that condemned him that night and beat him up. Now, by the way, you might notice that I skipped verse 28. If you have King James Bible, I must make you mad sometimes when I do this, but check me. Verse 28 is not in the best manuscripts. I don't think it's original. I think it was later added. It's only in manuscript K, which the King James is based on. It's not in Aleph. It's not in A. It's not in B. It's not in C. It's just not in the best manuscripts we have. So 28 is just not, should not be there. I don't think it's original. Now, in 29 it says, excuse me, 31. And the priests, too, made sport of him to one another, saying, along with the scribes, and saying, "He saved others, but he can't save himself." You see, they couldn't deny that he raised Lazarus from the dead. They couldn't deny that he healed people. They just said it was insignificant. What they really said, his power comes from the devil. But they couldn't deny that. They just made fun of it. Let Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, so that we may see and believe. No, John 11:40 says, you believe and then you see. It doesn't work the other way. They kept asking for signs. He kept saying no. In reality, he'd already given them all the signs they needed. They just refused to see. Now, then it says, even the men who were crucified with him made sport of him, imperfect tense. They made fun of him over and over again. It's only in Luke 23, verses 39 through 43, that the account of one of those thieves in the middle of mocking him said, Jesus, have pity on me when you come in your kingdom. And Jesus turned to that man and said, I will. You'll be with me today. Hey, this guy didn't know who he was really. This guy didn't understand theology. This guy just knew he was in a desperate place. And even on death's door, Jesus said, yeah, you can come with me. Come on. That's why I do believe that deathbed confessions are true. Jesus took this guy with no chance to live for him, with exercising just a minute amount of faith, with great ignorance of all, and said, yeah, I'll take you with me. Now, notice if you would, let's see, verse 33, at 12 o'clock, that's the sixth hour here, by the way. Again, we have that flip-flopping of different times. Darkness covered the whole land. And lasted until 3 in the afternoon, or the ninth hour. This is much like, I think, the darkness that fell on Egypt during the plagues, Exodus 10:21. Darkness is often a sign of God's judgment. I really believe that this is what Jesus feared so terribly in the Garden of Gethsemane. This is what I believe he prayed, O Father, if there's any way, let this cup pass me. What was Jesus afraid of? I believe he was afraid of being separated from the Father. I believe the darkness symbolizes the fact that God turned his face away from his son. I believe when Jesus cries out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama, sabachthani. That's Aramaic for my God, why have you forsaken me? I think for the first time in his life, Jesus experienced the last great experience of sinful man, separation from God. I think 2 Corinthians 5:21 puts it so well when it says that God took him who knew no sin and made him become sin that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Friends, here is the Lamb of God dying in your place, separated from the Father, cut off, alone, bearing the sins of man. You ought to read Psalm 22. Now, I want to say to you that the Peshitta translation is a very good translation from about the 5th century on. The manuscript is very, very faithful as far as keeping the same witnesses. It says, for I was kept for this, or something like that. It speaks of his destiny. But I really think a more accurate translation, going back to the Hebrew of Psalms 22, is, why have you forsaken me? Although both are a possibility. Okay? Now, in verse 35 it says, and some of the bystanders, when he said this, said, listen, he's calling for Elijah. Now, in Aramaic, the term Elijah is Eliah. Okay? And the term for God is Eli. And if you make it plural, it's Eloi. So, Eliah and Eloi sound pretty close in the wind that was blowing, I bet. And so, apparently, they thought he was calling for Elijah because Elijah is the prophet that comes to the Jews in times of aid. And these souls said, hey, don't give me anything to drink. Let's see if Elijah comes. Hard-hearted bunch of folks. Now, so one man ran up, soaked a sponge in vinegar. Now, in John 19:28, Jesus says, I'm thirsty. Why would Jesus drink the vinegar but wouldn't drink the other stuff on the way? Well, I think what we have here is this vinegar is the very cheap wine that everybody drank. Going back to Isaiah, let me see if I can find it here. I was looking for a reference. Yeah, it's Psalms 22:15. It says that my throat is so dry that I can't even speak. I think Jesus had a couple of more things to say, and I think he took that drink of cheap wine just so he could articulate the last few words that he wanted to say. Now, that's just my opinion. He doesn't say it in the text, but I really think that fits. Now, so he put it on a stick and held it up to him to drink, saying, well, I'll wait and see if Elijah comes before you give him that. Verse 37. Then Jesus gave a loud cry. We don't know what it is in Mark, but in John 19:30, it's recorded, it is finished. And it says he bowed his hand in the crook of his arm and he died and gave up the ghost. Now here it says, and the curtain of the sanctuary was torn in two from top to bottom. Now I want you to think in your mind with me, because I think here's another place where we have misunderstood the Bible. Think with me of the temple. And you got the court of the Gentiles, the court of the women, the court of the Jews, and then the court where the priests are. And inside that court is a large building. It's a long rectangle, and the front of it is the holy place where the showbread and the candle and the incense thing is. And it has a curtain in the front of it. If you go through that curtain, you're in the holy place. There's another curtain, and then back behind that is the Holy of Holies. Now, most of the time, this has been interpreted as the Holy of Holy veil was ripped open. Well, there's two veils that are just alike, except their position. You find a description from them in Exodus 26, 31 through 35. If the inner veil was ripped from top to bottom, no one would see it but the priest. But if the outer veil was ripped from the top to the bottom, everyone in the temple could see. They could see through those different courts. The gates were lined up. We could see inside. They could see that the way to God was symbolically opened at the moment of the death of Christ. Now notice it didn't tear from the bottom to the top, which would be possible by men. It tore from the top to the bottom, which symbolizes that God did it. And I think it was the outer curtain that was torn open in symbol that the way to God has been opened up. Notice, if you would, please, where it mentions in verse 39, and when the captain who stood facing him saw that he expired in this way, he said, this man was surely God's son. Now, you all see other accounts. This is Luke 23:47, Matthew 27:54, or other accounts of this. Now, it is true that grammatically, this Roman is not saying that Jesus is the only Son of God. What he's saying is this was a Son of God. But friends, this was a crusty old Roman soldier that had had the unfortunate duty of being assigned to crucifying men, probably crucified a lot of men. He'd seen a lot of men die, but he never saw anyone die like this one died. Never saw anyone say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Never saw anyone say, hey, John, take care of my mother, would you? Never saw anyone die like this one died. And he says, surely this was God's son. Now, I don't know how much light he had, but this man was trying to make a genuine affirmation of faith based on the light that he had. Now, whether this was an affirmation of faith that was enough to get him to heaven, I don't know. But this man's heart has been turned toward the God of Israel as much as he understands it. I hope I'll meet that soldier one day. Because the best I can do is live up to the light that God gives me. This man did that. I think it's a tremendous affirmation of someone who had seen a lot of folks die. This is not a pleasant scene, but I think it tells us something as Christians of the costliness of sin, that something has to die. You see, the gospel is free, but friends, don't you ever think it's cheap. The gospel's free because you can't earn it or deserve it or merit it. But I want you to know it cost us everything that we are. It's the pearl of great price. Jesus paid an awful high price that you might know true forgiveness. Jesus left the glories of heaven to become poor that you might become rich. I want you to think about that. That song that we are so popular today, the day he wore my crown. Friends, that should have been you up there. Your sin is what put him there. That should have been you. Jesus took your place. And he loves you so much. And he wants you to know him. We'll be looking at the resurrection next week. It's a good time. There's not a stone big enough or a grave deep enough to keep Jesus from going to the Father. And I'm so glad there's not a stone big enough or a grave deep enough to keep me from him when he comes again. I hope you're ready. God bless you. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again same time, same place next week.